Welcome to The Right Chamber,
the podcast where we dive deep into the fascinating world of medicine and healthcare.
In every episode, we will talk about pivotal topics relating to medicine and surgery in the UK and what it's like to be a healthcare professional today. We are inviting doctors and other healthcare professionals across different specialties to discuss their experiences and give an insight into what their journey has been like. Please follow us on Instagram and TikTok at RGUCMS and subscribe to our YouTube channel, RGUC Media. So sit back, ignore the traffic, and enjoy the Right Chamber podcast.
Jackie Elson Whittaker began her career as a dental nurse in the 1980s before becoming a registered general nurse in 1992. Specializing in cardiology, she worked in coronary care and heart failure, becoming a BHF pilot nurse in 2003. Her career includes research roles, international experience, and a master's in professional healthcare studies with over 30 years at Sanwell and Dudley.
Glynis Whitefoot, a registered nurse since 2002, began her career in Brighton's intensive care unit and later became a heart failure specialist nurse at Queen Elizabeth Hospital, Birmingham. After working as an advanced nurse practitioner in general practice, she returned to heart failure at the Dudley Group.
Welcome back to the Right Chamber podcast. My name is Jaspreet and this is...
Victor.
Today we have Jackie and Glynis, our two heart failure nurses, and we're going to let them introduce themselves a little bit. Jackie, you first.
Hello, good afternoon. My name's Jackie Elson Whittaker. I'm a clinical lead nurse for Dudley Heart Failure Team, and I've worked in heart failure for over 20 years.
Well.
Glynis?
Hi, I'm Glynis. I'm one of the heart failure nurses within the team, and I've done heart failure on and off for 17 years.
Brilliant. Lovely to meet you both. And because we have lots of different specialties that tune into the podcast, I think it'd be really nice just to get a bit of an insight as to what you do and what your role entails as a heart failure nurse. So if you could just give us a little bit of an insight.
Heart failure, as you know, it's a syndrome. Okay. It's been going on for many, many years and had lots and lots of treatments. Because I've been doing cardiology for 30 years, I've seen many advancements in heart failure therapy. And so our role when I first started, it was new. There weren't any heart failure nurses about. I was one of the pilot projects for the British Heart Foundation that was run by a study in Glasgow. And at that time, most of our role was education and support. And then trying to get them on little bits of tablets that we were scared of, like what we call ACE inhibitors, ramipril. There was very limited what we could give the patients, and the prognosis at that time, we're talking about the 2000, late 90s, 2000, was very, very poor. You could die in 12 months or 38.
Have a diagnosis.
Yeah, from diagnosis, yeah. Couldn't you? And then they did some studies and they found that the prognosis could be 5 years. But then once they'd started adding just those little bits of treatment in, they realised that we needed the likes of ACE inhibitors and beta blockers, which beta blockers in the past were kind of bad for heart failure, but they realised they had to give it at little doses and bring them up. They studied a similar population. It was called the Hillingdon study, and they showed that actually the mortality was getting better. But we were only given a few options at that time. So the heart failure nurse's role, I can remember the British Heart Foundation, they said, this is what you need to do when you first see a patient. You do this assessment, so it was very, very much tick box.
Regimen.
And then you give them this education, and you've got to give them this. Ticket and we were just assigned really to little areas of the borough that would help with the funding for the nurses, and they showed over time, over years, actually were making a massive impact to preventing admissions or preventing them from getting worse. And so they get, there became more and more of us, and I worked in Sandwell and West Birmingham, became Sandwell and West Birmingham. And from just two of us, they became 10 and then 15 over that time, because it was just little PCTs then and things changed. And I could see that happening in Dudley. Within the UK, it's very diverse. We're very lucky in the Black Country to have the teams we've got. But when it comes to our roles have changed as well, haven't they? I'll let you do a bit of talking.
No, that's fine. And I think, so 2007, I came into heart failure, and it's very much like Jack just said, you know, we'd see a patient and say, well, you know, this is your diagnosis. I'm terribly sorry. You possibly got 5 years, but, you know, you may have a VF arrest or something in the meantime if we don't give you this. And we'd start people on beta blockers when I first started, and we'd have to sit with them for
We'd have a beta blocker clinic.
Which it just seems mad now. I mean, we'd have to sit with them for an hour.
Yeah. Explaining it.
No, keep doing their observations.
You know, like you've heard of ACE inhibitors, yeah. Like amipril, perindopril. There wasn't any likes of the advanced treatments that we've got now, but they used to have to be admitted to hospital to have what
to a have it.
Just to be observed. Yeah, they take a CCU bed or something, yeah. Or they're coming in to have a Captopril trial. How things have changed.
Mad, absolutely mad. But that was normal. That's what we did. And so it was more about the education, but we try and get these medications up and about. But then devices came into the mix, really. And where I worked previously, it was very much sort of a device centre, and devices would be kind of the primary treatment, and the medications we were given were almost secondary.
Do you know what we mean by devices?
No.
So when we talk about devices for heart failure, it's for defibrillators, ICDs, and for cardiac resynchronization therapy, pacemakers, where you get three leads.
Which help the heart pump more effectively.
Yeah, pump that basically helps the pacing and pumping action. And they came out, I'd been doing heart failure nursing for a few years before we got that, and they were like, this is the new thing. We fast realised that some patients, some of them responded really well, some of them didn't. And over time, the modus ortus changed, is that, no, we don't put these devices in quickly. We get them on what we call medical therapy. We often say to the patients, this is the chemotherapy for your heart. We get them on the medical therapy. And we've stopped choosing words like nephrotoxics.
Yeah.
We used to only give tiny doses, didn't we?
Yeah.
Things like, as I said, ramipril before, we'd look at the kidney function and we'd notice the creatinine go up a short. We could keep them on a small dose. It's not like that anymore. It was often the diuretics that were causing that, not the ACE inhibitors. So our role has changed massively in the way that we've thought about optimization of medication.
And the drugs, of course, have changed massively, haven't they? So I left heart failure with that, really, with devices and, you know, 5, maybe 10-year prognosis. Things had improved a little, left and then came back. And now, you know, with the new medications we've got now, it's changed, isn't it? The prognosis has improved.
Yeah, we our role now is gone from, yes, our day-to-day job covers so much. They've got patients with heart failure have always got a coexisting issue, whether it's just ischemic heart disease, but they've usually got diabetes or renal impairment. And it is part of education and support. It's optimization of medication, but we're also looking at holistic things, because with our patients, they've been given a devastating diagnosis. They don't quite understand that it's just as bad. The prognosis is worse than some cancers, but they don't understand that. They often say, oh, thank God it's not cancer.
Yeah.
So a lot of our role, that when we have to say, well, actually, you know, we've got to be looking after it, we give them that element of hope, but we also, part of our role is palliative and emotional and mental support. And it's not just patients. we have to think about those people that support them and care
their families
for them.
And yeah.
It's about everybody. It's looking at God's name.
They say, if that word heart failure, isn't it?
Yeah, they think they're going to drop down dead. Really, that's what we have.
That's often
it?
On all death certificates, isn't it?
Yeah, that's failure. It. They would have known that their parents or maybe other people on a death certificate said heart
failure. It's like their heart failed. Yeah. So if you were not today here, like doing the podcast today, what would you be doing today? As
well, obviously it's slightly different for me because Jackie's the lead, but for me it would be doing home visits, phone calls, letters, referrals, that kind of thing, to see patients on a day-to-day basis. So we do home visits in the community team, as well as clinics where people come in to see us, but generally on a day that I don't have a clinic, I'd be doing home visits.
So what does that entail, like?
So going to see patients in their own home, and ensuring that they have the same access to the medications and the services and the expertise that people that are able and mobile and able to come to a clinic have. So it's, you know, it's all about equality, really, and ensuring that everyone's getting the, you know, the best service that they possibly can.
It really does spread out the service to people who need it the most, and rather everything come in either through A&E or go in directly to the GP. If we're aware of the people who need the service, then it's pretty much like targeted
treatment. And diagnosis is improving, isn't it? We are getting more earlier diagnoses of heart failure than we used to, because we're not waiting for we're not waiting for somebody to develop symptoms of heart failure where they're full of fluid. So like a decomp, is it? We're more catching them a little earlier with, they're going to their GPs with fatigue, and then that could trigger the, you know, a certain blood test that looks for an enzyme.
But it's coming up to Heart Failure Awareness Week in May every year, the European Society of Cardiology. And last year, we did a big campaign about awareness. It's called BEAT. So it's breathlessness, exhaustion, ankle swelling. It's time to get a blood test or see a GP. So we weren't just educating the patients. We were also going into GP surgeries. We've got the T-shirts on. We've got the posters. And there is a special blood test that they can request. They should do other things as well. The clinical assessment is, because you can't just rely on one blood test, but it's trying to get, when a patient comes to the surgery whether it's a health, allied healthcare professional or a GP, they should be thinking, whatever age they are, we get young patients, then they think, I'm getting more breathlessness, I'm getting exhausted. You should be doing that blood test thinking, actually, could it be heart failure? We often get, especially our younger ones that have been diagnosed, they're the ones, they look okay, so they get dismissed, and they're the ones that often have the worst outcome if you don't catch them early.
How young can the patients be?
Well, any age. You can have
20-odd-year-old at the moment.
Any age. Obviously, there's different etiologies of causes of heart failure, so, you know. Not here, but in other areas, you know, see with congenital issues. But at any age, you can, you know, your heart can start to fail for whatever reason.
So it's really important for, you know, GPs and just healthcare practitioners in general
to keep that aware.
Differential, you know, keep that at the back of your mind.
Absolutely. You know, family history, what else has gone on, you know, illnesses when they were younger, you know, just keeping that open mind really as to what other comorbidities, what else have they got wrong with them, and having a little look at, you know, what else it can do. That the blood test that can be done, it isn't a diagnosis of heart failure by any stretch of the imagination, and it can point to other things, but it's certainly a nod towards, you know, well, we can do, you know, through the processes, we can do A, B and C, or the GP can do A, B and C through it. So yeah.
Part of my role as a clinical leader, so I was a heart failure champion for Health Innovation West Midlands, is working with the primary care and education. We've done some teaching sessions, we've done case studies. I find pharmacists soak it up. They're very much into medicine management, making sure they are optimised on the therapies because it's a heart failure team, we can't keep our heart failure patients. So once we discharge them, once they're stable and we've optimised them, we allow self-referrals back. We've been doing PIFU for years, but informally. But we need the surgeries to make sure they're looked after as well. So they should get those heart failure reviews. Part of my role is that, I mean, I do cover for the team.
Yeah.
And it's not just about the community. It's making sure that our colleagues in the hospital are aware of the pathways for heart failure.
Absolutely.
We've got an acute team here, and we've also got a virtual ward. So the patients can be facilitated a discharge earlier and have more intense monitoring before they're let out into the big wide world. Yeah, but some of these patients do need intense monitoring. So if we can get that medication in, even if it's small doses within the first few weeks of a diagnosis, it's a better outcome for the patient. A low dose is better than no dose.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because we keep touching on comorbidities, like the renal.
It is a huge.
If they go on the virtual ward, we know that they're going to get the community nurses. Their role is we should see patients within 2 weeks for routines. Urgents, we see them much, much sooner, within a few days, if we get that notification that we're sending this patient home. And we like the acute nurses to know about those patients so they can go and see the patients on the ward, whether they're cardiology ward or that they're in the outlying wards. We work really well with the consultant cardiologists. We've got 3 cardiologists that really specialise in heart failure now. So they will go out with the acute nurses to the outlying wards and offer a management plan. So the patient gets exposed to the acute nurse and that little bit of drip feeding that they've got a heart failure diagnosis. What tablets are you taking now? So they're getting more ready before they're discharged. If the patients have been admitted with a new diagnosis, you do expect them to be in that the average time is 10 to 14 days because they can be in such a bad way. With a virtual ward, it can facilitate them to get out a little bit earlier and they can have their own bed instead.
Mm.
If social circumstances and everything allow.
Yeah.
So it's not just about, we've got a community team, it's a big team and we would like, it's getting people to know about what we do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think lots of people listening, going to be getting that insight right now. So it's really, really good that you've come on. I mean, even when I do my clerking shifts in ED, a lot of the times just the patients that we do get are perhaps those people who perhaps they would have benefited from that optimization.
Yeah.
And maybe they were just lost to follow up at one stage or the other. And so that we do our best to stabilize the patient. We get them seen by our cardiology team. And then the other bits that I picked up is on that discharge, it's just so, so important to make sure that there are things put in place to make sure that we can actually keep them, keep them stable.
Yeah.
And make sure that there are those pathways that people are aware of. So I think, it's really, really important, isn't it?
I think for resident doctors, we don't realize how much work goes into it. Mm. We diagnose a patient and then we just ring up the heart failure nurses.
So that's what we're here for. That's why you've got specialist teams, isn't it?
We're out there, we're doing ECGs, bloods, we're running around making sure they get prescriptions on time. Once you send them out... A lot of our job is we get phone calls, I'm going to run out of the furosemide.
Yeah.
And that's what all those years ago when the heart failure nurse started, they realised that the key time to see those patients is in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Because they're either getting dehydrated and we're sending them into renal failure.
Yeah.
Or they're just not, that some of the tablets that were given to them while they were in the hospital, they're just not tolerating. Or they're they need that key support, don't they? They just need someone to talk
to.
You guys have done a great job getting them stabilised, because that's what acute heart failure management is. Get them stabilised. Give them a diuretic because they can't breathe. Make sure they have all the right blood tests. Make sure what could be causing this. Are they anemic, for example? What's exacerbated it? Have they got an infection? Doing all that business, get them stabilised and making sure that we drip feed them with a bit of the main tablets like the ACE inhibitors. You wouldn't give a beta blocker until you got some of the fluid off them. Yeah, so you get all that. And then our job is to pick up those pieces. And Dudley's very diverse, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It's got affluent and it's got some very poor areas.
Deprived areas.
And it's got a large elderly population. So when you think there may be a lot of heart failure nurses, it's because there's so many elderly with the
elderly people.
We cover a big area as well. You know, Dudley's a massive...
We go as far from Hagley, Hales Owen, Coseley,
Rowley,
Seasden, Wanbourne, yeah, Kimber. It's a massive area. Which is why the virtual wards help when it comes to intense monitoring, because obviously it's some of they do virtual contacts.
Oh, that's great. That means you can, there's greater access now, isn't it, to you. So it's not everyone that you'll actually end up physically going to
their house or...
A face-to-face assessment is always the best.
Ideal.
Preferable.
It's always the best.
If you can, then this is a good alternative.
And generally, they do get face-to-face.
Once you've seen the patient once and you've got to know them, that's why you can see them in a clinic. You don't know the full story in a clinic, do you?
No, it's only when you go to their house that you kind of realise what else is going on.
But then you can kind of, they start to develop a trust in you that you're not just... going to pile on these tablets, you're going to work with them and negotiate with them. And when you talked about medication and compliance and concordance, it's about working with the patient, isn't it? And so they get home and they have a boatload of tablets.
And it can be so daunting.
Yeah, I think a lot of patients just don't want to take those medications.
Well, they don't know, or they've looked at the leaflet, haven't they? And, oh, I'm not taking that because that's going to cause this. And, oh, no, you know, somebody up the road took that. And then
they've done it in, they took them in hospital because it's given to them.
Because it's given to them. And then the nurses watch them take it as well.
They have the choice. Yeah, they have the choice, don't they? Suddenly then I think when you're in hospital, your power's taken away from you and you do just take the tablets because that's what's, and you're feeling so awful as well. You just want to feel better. Yeah. But when you get home, you're feeling better. You think, oh, well, I'm better now. I don't need these tablets anymore.
I don't know if you noticed it. Like the biggest comment that patients say is, I just didn't want to get up to go to the toilet. When we asked them, like, why'd you not take your furosemide? It's like, didn't want to wee that much. We're like, okay, but we gave you these times. Why did you not stick to it? Just didn't want to get up and wee.
And that's where you have to negotiate with them, because once they're home, they're their own bosses again.
Yes. Right? Yeah.
So rather than this talking at each other, if you can find a way to work together, and then you find that compliance goes up, because we've actually had a conversation. That's, you saw where the problems were, the times that actually I should be taking it. And as you said, when you go to the house, probably you then notice, oh, now I get it. The stairs are over here and your room is over. Okay.
Like the bathroom is not accessible. That's why they don't want to.
And not everyone goes to bed at, you know, 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night, do they? Some people will stay up all night. So it's about negotiating with the patient and working out what's best for them. Because generally, as long as they take them, not really that bothered.
When you see, you might send them home with furosemide, 80 milligrams in the morning, and then it's especially on the discharge somewhere, it's something like 12 noon. Well, they might have only got up at 10.
Yes.
So they take the first two at 10 and then, oh, I've got to take it at 12. Yeah. So all of a sudden they virtually took 120 milligrams together.
Within
very short
and they wonder why
their blood pressure's gone. Like that.
Kidneys, they just start feeling awful and then they end up in the hospital again.
Yeah.
It's like a vicious cycle.
It is. And of course, if you take a tablet and it makes you feel ill, If you can stop
it, associate it. Yeah.
So, you know, there's lots of different reasons. It's so complex, isn't it, really, about... But we generally say to people, well, as long as you take them, if it suits you,
yeah,
that's fine. It's not written in stone.
But we do work with them. But you can't just assume that the patient, for example, some patients are night owlers. And if they want to take the diuretic at 6 o'clock at night... Then let them.
It's up to them.
Especially to them. If the main symptom was shortness of breath at night, the waking, then they could take it that time. You just have to listen to them.
We're all different, aren't we?
And when it comes to, like, you say, going home and it's the passing the urine issue, there may be incontinent. We signpost to other services.
Yeah.
That's a lot of our time is taken up signposting.
Referring to our teams.
But also it's like, have they got the right equipment in place? And sometimes we can make the life so much better by just ordering a commode.
Yeah. I think education is so important. So if you told them, like, look, the reason we've given you these times is so that, you know, you can empty your bladder before you go to bed. So you don't have to wake up. Mm. You say, but it depends on when you go to bed. And then let them tweak their own times. Because I think we fail at that, where we just write it and say, take it at 8 and take it at 12.
But of course, that's the way it's got to be.
It. And then they read it and they're like, okay.
Yeah.
But I woke up at 10.
Yeah.
And I want to take it at 12 again. But I think if you just let them be.
Yeah. It's part of that whole patient-centered care, isn't it?
Absolutely. Because that will ultimately improve compliance, won't it? If you're taking accountability and you're taking control of it, and you're going to do it, aren't you, really?
They're more likely to complain.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think working with them is the biggest thing. And that's why we emphasise that time with the patient. We can be in a house. We can be in one home visit. Can take over an hour.
Yeah, it can be. It can be.
It's a very time-consuming role.
Yeah, it can be. But justifiably, if we're getting people taking their tablets and... You know, we're going to prevent, we're not only improving mortality, morbidity outcomes, but actually we're going to, you know, improve their quality of life, which doesn't always get looked at. So it's worth it. It's worth every penny.
Yeah. And part of the reason why we get up in the morning is to see those patients appreciate you, but also the fact that they improve, don't they? Especially with the advancements of what we've got now, and there's probably more to come. It's when they go for a repeat scan, an echo, and their LV function's improved.
Yeah.
It's just such a good feeling for them.
It's lovely to phone somebody, isn't it, and say, you're not cured, but...
It's getting better.
You know, your ejection fraction is improved.
I mean, we still get the ones, well, why do I feel so good?
I know.
But you have to remember that we're going about the tablets, okay? It is a big part of it.
Yeah, of course.
But the other big part is getting them to move.
Lifestyle,
Okay, so we've got wonderful action art, but not everybody can do action art for accessibility. They do try the best, don't they, art? They're fantastic.
They are very good.
But it is getting them to move just in their own home, or we have to work with them, as I say, because you've got the little old ladies with the Zimmer frames, you're not going to get them to action art, are you?
But something is better than nothing.
But we just say to them, well, you getting up out of your chair is so much better for you. And we do a bit of that exercise, a little bit to
chair-based
exercises. So that's why we've been doing the job for such a long time. It's because it's so diverse. So the spectrum, it's not just sitting in a clinical day.
That's right, it's not, is it?
We all meet together every morning. We have a little huddle on Teams, don't we? There's three teams at 8:15 every morning, and that is part of the role, really, because we talk about the patients. So if patients have been admitted that we know about, we have a chat about them with the acute nurses, so if there's any issues, they can then relate to the doctors and the nurses on the wards, and vice versa, they talk about other patients.
And you all get to know people with chronic
there's always that, does anyone know such and such,
somebody back, or she's back.
We know them. And then they give a bit more of a story, because it's all about that jigsaw, isn't it, and putting the pieces together and finding out, well, that's what's happened.
And we find that We keep like a bit of a hospital board. It's electronic, so it's on our Outlook calendar. So we can see which patients are in on the acute board. And you know what? Most of the time, they're not in for heart failure.
It's for other things, aren't they? Unfortunately,
But they get admitted for something that's not heart failure, but often sometimes the heart failure tablets are changed. So then we have to pick up the pieces when we get back. But when they get back home, don't we?
Yeah.
Sometimes they have to be changed. Sometimes they have to be stopped. If they've gone in with an AKI, and which is another thing we're doing now. Patients, we talk about medication. I mean, they some of them are so good at taking the tablets. Yeah. They can feel, or they maybe get diarrhea and sickness bug, right? And they still take the tablets because they think if they don't, they're going to end up in heart failure again. So what we do, we've got sick day rules. They can contest us if they're not sure, but I say there's certain tablets you shouldn't be taking.
Yeah.
And if it's only for a few days, it's not going to hurt you. When you feel better, you can restart them again, because we want to try and prevent patients coming in because they're dehydrated. Yeah. It does seem to
work. But going back to the, you know, when patients are in and medications are changed, there's always the acute team that will be more than happy just to see them and advise and, you know, well, should we be stopping everything or what can we keep? And, you know, even if it's a phone call,
So I think that's useful for our resident doctors. Don't be afraid to pick up the phone.
Just ask them. You know, they're all so knowledgeable and, you know, if it prevents things being stopped, because sometimes what happens is that they get stopped and then they don't get restarted.
I think that's the problem.
If the acute team didn't know about them, they've been discharged from us and it's been missed. And of course the GP's, oh, well, that must have been stopped for a really good reason, rather than it just being, well, we'll just stop it for now.
Yeah.
So they never get restarted. And then they come back to us again, you know, further down the line, in a bit of a worse state. And that's what we want to try. And, you know, we need to keep these people as well as we can for as long as we can.
Yeah, sometimes they get... We're used to patients having a blood pressure of 95 systolic, for example. And their medications for heart failure often can drop the blood pressure. Or there might be what people think of bradycardic, but we want them to be...
Yeah.
Especially if they've got a cardiac resynchronization device in, we want the pacemaker to do the job.
We need it pacing.
They say, oh, the heart rate's 50, and they go and stop it. And we're like, no, don't stop the beta blockers. Unless they're symptomatically hypotensive, we don't stop. I had a 50-odd-year-old lady who's got was referred to me by the cardiologist, and she presented with a blood pressure of just under 100.
Yeah.
And all she was on was a tablet called Losartan. And she got severe left ventricular dysfunction. You know what? We've got her on all the four pillars now. And her blood pressure is still between 90 and 100, but she feels much better. She thought that one of the tablets called sacubitril valsartan, she thought that was causing a cough. So she decided to stop it. And then she realised how much she needed it. And she's gone back on it again. And she said, I can live with a bit of a cough because I can do more with this tablet. But a blood pressure, she wasn't symptomatic. But if she presented into A&E
saw her blood pressure, like fluids and stop her medication. Well, yeah,
because her news too would have been...
Yeah, flagged up.
Absolutely. You know, her news too would be triggering the sepsis sort of pathway.
I think like sometimes we just have a chat with the patient. Because like
For them?
Yeah, like sometimes like, you know, the nurses would be like, patient's heart rate is this. That's okay. And then the cute little old lady would be like, this is normal for me. Like, okay. That's fine.
Because a lot of our patients will know what is their normal.
Yeah, this is their normal and they feel fine.
Absolutely. And I think as long as they're feeling fine, then that's kind of the main thing. I always think with heart failure, I think I spend my whole days going, whatever we tell you, no one else is ever going to tell you. I said, because it's just us. It's our little niche and this is what we do. So this is what we say because this is right for us. And
I think post-COVID, COVID, I know it's terrible, but they all decided to buy blood pressure machines.
Yeah. Everyone's got their own blood before.
Because nobody wanted to come into the hospital.
No one had them. And the SATS probe.
Yeah.
I don't know anyone that had a SATS probe.
And they all come with a clipboard. So it's on the you think that we just said it's an elderly population. Yeah. So many have got the phones with the graphs on.
Yeah, right too, and the hat and the watches.
And just health monitoring generally now is a lot more.
I think you're right, COVID has certainly improved that. But that's great for us.
Yeah.
Because then really, you know, they're doing our job.
It's about self-empowerment, isn't it?
Yeah, they need to take control of their own.
It just goes back again to that whole patient centered care, empowering the patient to take charge of their own health and their own care. So I think it's just so important. I'm just wary of our time here, but just I think some important words to kind of get in might be, so there's a nurse right now who's perhaps thinking or just considering the idea of going into, you know, heart failure nursing. Is there anything that you, or you know, just briefly, that you might want to advise for that person?
I'll let you.
Well, I think, you know, if anyone's got an interest in cardiology and specifically heart failure, so not just nurses, but if there's any doctors out there, then, you know, it's not seen as a sexy subject. However, it's so interesting and it's so diverse. And I think find your local team. Go and chat to them and see what they say. Spend some time with them because it's so interesting. It really, really is. You know, I left, came back, and I'm loving life.
I am absolutely loving life. As I say, you get to do like so many different courses.
The diversity.
You don't have to go on loads of courses, but I've been given those opportunities. Yeah. I wouldn't have managed to do academically wise what I do without the passion there.
With that
passion, because you know that the master's degree that I did was work based, so it was all for the benefit of the heart failure patients. So every module I did was to do with looking after those patients, but that includes learning all about cardiac rehab, learning all about ECG. I got the You know, you learn all about ECGs, you learn all about renal function. Yeah. We're so fortunate as well. We've got an MDT with a renal physician joining us, and we also have a palliative MDT as well. So working in all that scope, I think, for anybody that likes diversity, and it's definitely a challenge, then it's definitely a job to...
And times are changing, you know. It's an exciting time to be involved in heart failure because... You know, therapies are constantly changing and there's different, you know, there's the traditional community team, there's the acute teams, there's the virtual wards that, of course, are becoming a lot more, you know, prevalent as well. So there's so much that you could do. But I think just grab somebody from a heart failure team and just see because they're all so enthusiastic about it, I think.
I can see it from your passion right now.
Absolutely.
You actually have like job satisfaction.
Yeah, and we've got... In some areas, I've even got pharmacists that specialise in heart failure. So it's really that people do enjoy. The pharmacists have that passion as well. They really enjoy looking after the heart failure patient. It's definitely a job that I wouldn't want to do anything else.
Thank you for talking to us. And I think this was a very knowledgeable session.
Absolutely. I think there's a lot to gain from that. Just the points at the end, you know, talk to someone, learn more about it. There's such diversity in this specialty. And then it's changed so much over the last few years. And actually, it's still an actively evolving specialty. So thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. It's been really enjoyable just to hear your passion, or you can feel it from this side of the chair. Thank you to everyone who has been tuning in to the podcast. We really do appreciate the support and the interaction as well. So I think if there's any questions you have or anything that you're not quite sure of from our discussion today, feel free to just interact with on our various platforms, post questions, post your comments or feedback as well.
or your recommendations or what you'd like to see.
Happy to get back to you on that. And if you'd like to take part in the podcast as well, again, feel free to contact us on any of the RGUC platforms. Thank you very, very much, and take care.
Remember to stay connected with us on social media. Follow us on Instagram and TikTok at RGUCMS, and subscribe to our YouTube channel, RGUC Media, for more exclusive content and updates. Thanks for tuning in to the Right Chamber podcast. Until next time.